everything just closed up. It rained so hard in just like an hour, maybe 2 hours. And every possible way out of Santa Barbara was plugged up, closed, flooded, impossible to leave the area.
That's Mitch Bernstein, who is stranded in Santa Barbara and cannot get back to his house in Solvang. Parts of Santa Barbara County, including all of Montecito and portions of Carpinteria and Summerlin, are under evacuation orders as heavy rains drench the scarred land from past wildfires. Statewide, tens of thousands more are under evacuation orders, and at least 16 people are dead after back-to-back heavy storms have been drenching the state since the beginning of the year. Here in Los Angeles, a flood watch is in effect for most of the county through this evening. Another storm is in the forecast for this weekend. Joining me now to discuss all of this, we have two guests. Lucy Jones is a seismologist and author of The Big Ones, How Natural Disasters Have Shaped Us and What We Can Do About Them. And Leah Stokes is a professor of energy and climate policy at UC Santa Barbara. Welcome back to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us on.
Well, Leah, let's begin with you because you're in Santa Barbara and I guess classes have been canceled at your university, UC Santa Barbara, and 10,000 people or so have been evacuated. What are you seeing right now?
Well, it's really shocking to see parts of the community just completely underwater. I mean, there's a video of a man kayaking through the roads, and I know where that is, and that is not a place where there's normally water. I mean, looking at the surges through the creeks is just unbelievable, except of course this happened 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. Exactly 5 years ago to the day. Interestingly, classes had similarly been canceled, and we had these terrible mudslides in Montecito that killed 23 people. And we know that this is related to climate change, right? Because extreme rainfall, forest fires that disrupt the soils, all of this is linked to climate change. And it's hitting even one of the richest areas in the whole country.
Right. And why is your area in particular, the Santa Barbara area, particularly vulnerable to this kind of heavy rain?
Well, California writ large is starting to see these kinds of really extreme rainfall events. And there's been scientific studies. There was a big report on megastorms in the summer in the New York Times, which talked about how we could have rainfall that could last something like a month. I mean, that isn't what we're seeing now, but that can continue to get worse. And at the event 5 years ago, when 23 people died, half an inch of rain fell in 5 minutes in Montecito. That's why those mudslides were triggered, in addition to because of the Thomas Fire, which had disturbed all the soils and basically made them more prone to mudslides. So climate change is basically leading to warmer air. It's creating these kinds of atmospheric rivers that are hitting California. And of course, it's not just happening in Santa Barbara. It's happening in LA, in San Luis Obispo. It's happening in Sacramento, in the Bay Area. It's really all across the state. And it's because of climate change.
And Lucy, you have studied this particular phenomenon, this massive storm. It's called an arc storm. Tell us what that is. And are we witnessing it now, or could we be witnessing it now?
We're getting close. While climate change has made these more common, California has had these for thousands of years. Most of the time, we only get one or two atmospheric rivers at a time. Sometimes those are the path changes and we get one after the other, and they'll go on until they stop. And each progressive one makes things worse. So these really intense rains and massive flooding were what California was like in the 19th century. And then we built all of our flood control systems to keep them from happening. So a decade ago, the U.S. Geological Survey, when I was there, I led a project with a lot of colleagues to create a model of what a really big storm would be like to modern California, just like we did for the earthquake. And what we modeled was actually less than what happened in 1861-62, but still led to damage about four times as great as what a big San Andreas earthquake would do. So what these studies showed us is that we are actually quite susceptible to flooding in California. We've gotten rid of our moderate ones with our flood control. And, you know, each successive wave is going to make things worse. And it really does depend on when this stops.
Right. And we don't know when it'll stop, right? We know maybe 3 days out how much rain we're going to get. But after that, it's a guess.
Well, we, you know, actually part this whole process that allowed us to identify atmospheric rivers also has been part of a process that's allowing the meteorologists to do better predictions. But, you know, at least for the time I've been tracking, I keep on seeing, you know, the 10-day prediction still has rain as likely continuing in. And so the big issues would be like, where do the levees break and how, you know, how much stress are we putting on our levees? When we did the arc storm, there was damage across the state without question. And, you know, the massive debris flows wherever you've got the fire damage. But some of the most extensive flooding problems are in the areas well prone to it, things like the Central Valley, or indeed, you know, a certain amount of Orange County. Remember, we were seeing all that flooding in Tustin. Mm-hmm. Orange County, a lot of it actually is the floodplain of the San Gabriel River, which, by the way, moved by 6 miles in the floods of 1861-62.
And this was a storm that took place over 2 months. So, and right. It was just persistent rain for 2 months, which is what caused this flooding. What we're seeing now has lasted, what, a couple of weeks? And
right.
Could persist? We don't
so
know.
So far. Right.
Yeah.
So far, we're probably at the level that we saw, say, in 1969 or 1997 or 98. You know, we've had various times in the past where we've had it like this. You know, imagine if it stays in this track and we now get everything we've had already again, right? Mm-hmm. We now have fully saturated ground and the amount of flooding that we can get from it can go much higher. We haven't hit some of the burn areas that could have really come down, haven't been hit too hard so far. So unfortunately, the details end up mattering, but the longer we sort of keep the floodgates open, the worse it's going to get.
Right. And Leah, you study climate change and the effects of it. How much of this is being modeled as this is the, I hate to say this phrase because it's overused, but the new normal, that we're going to be seeing a lot more of these kinds of storms that last a long time with intense rainfall?
Well, the reason why the new normal doesn't make sense as a phrase is because it doesn't stay constant. If we keep putting greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, we will keep warming the planet. If we keep warming the planet, we're going to destabilize the climate even more. And what scientists are projecting is that, you know, while we have had extreme rainfall in California forever, that if we project out 50 years from now, we could be looking at rainfall that is peaking in the order of about 2 inches per hour. And so all the systems that we've built for the climate that was, they're not going to hold. They're obviously under a lot of stress, even for the climate that is. But keep in mind, we've warmed the planet by about 1.2 degrees centigrade so far, and we're on a pathway to continue to warm it to 1.5 degrees, maybe as much as 2 degrees. And so we're going to keep making this problem worse. And as much as it is challenging under the current moment to manage the climate change that is making these atmospheric rivers more likely, more common, more extreme, it's just going to get more challenging if we don't get off of fossil fuels.
Is there one bright spot in the fact that this might be easing the drought?
Sure. I mean, I live near Lake Kachuma, and people in Santa Barbara County, at least my friends, we all look at the water gauge all the time, and it was pretty insane. It was going up by about a percentage within an hour, which means yesterday it jumped by over 15% the last time I looked at it. I mean, the reservoir was quite low. It was at about 30%. Now it's closer to 50. So yes, that is good. We have to store water. But, you know, people having to evacuate their homes, mudslides. I mean, I know someone whose home was destroyed 5 years ago exactly in the mudslides, who just finished rebuilding it literally and had to evacuate and had flooding in their home again. I mean, wow. That's really such a sad situation, you know, mm-hmm. And of course, we can do things to try to manage it on the local level. And I think a lot of the changes that were made in Santa Barbara, you know, those creeks held in Montecito so far. So that's great. But, you know, if we don't get off of fossil fuels as a planet, as everyday people, you know, this is not going to stop.
Leah Stokes, professor at UC Santa Barbara, where she studies climate and energy policy. Lucy Jones, seismologist and author of The Big Ones, How Natural Disasters Have Shaped Us and What We Can Do About Them. Thank you both so much.
Sure.
Thanks.
up a lighter way to look at climate change through comedy. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. You name it, no matter how taboo or depressing, a comedian will find a way to skewer it.
But climate change, it is a real big deal. And everyone says Mother Nature. And I do believe nature is a woman because she's trying to kill us in the most passive-aggressive way possible. It's not some sort of immediate fire or flood or a cool explosion. She's just like... What? I raised the temperature a little. Oh, are you uncomfortable? Well, maybe I wouldn't have if you'd taken out the recycling like I am. I'm fine.
That's Michelle Wolf from her HBO special, Nice Lady. As weather events become more extreme, it can be hard to make the fate of our planet funny. But writer Kasia Patel argues that comedy can be a useful way to understand, maybe even cope with Earth's bleak future. She covers climate change and the environment for The Washington Post, where she wrote about this for their Hidden Planet column. And Kasia is a stand-up comedian herself. Hello.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, so... why did you include that Michelle Wolf bit in your article? What was it about what she said that strikes a chord with you?
Well, one, I thought it was very funny. And I also think she brings a pretty unique perspective to it because I think a lot of people are still trying to talk about climate change is real and give reasons for why it's real and, you know, perhaps even go against climate deniers in their joke. Whereas she, you know, at the very beginning, she says climate change is a real big deal and then just moves on from that, right? Like that's the given. And then she can actually talk about the more subtle ways that climate change is happening. And the fact that she pointed that out, that climate change isn't this big Nostradamus end of the world scenario, like, you know, you might see depicted on sci-fi movies. I thought that was really important of how she showed that.
Right. And like in general, the medicine goes down easier when you're laughing, right? I mean, you know both sides of this, right? Because you write serious articles about climate change, which, to be frank, not your articles, but the whole topic in general can be kind of eye glazing and people don't want to read it. But they will watch a comedy special and laugh at a joke that Michelle Wolf tells.
Right. And the good thing also about her joke and all the comedians that I talk about in this article, they don't talk about it for their entire act necessarily. That's what you get with a lot of these mainstream comedians. Climate change has become such a regular part of people's everyday lives that it just becomes an observation. You know, it's just like what they talk about their dating life. They talk about the weather. They talk about, you know, climate change and what's going on because it's just become such a...
it's become normal.
Yeah.
Okay, let's play another bit. This is from Nate Bargatze from his Netflix special, The Tennessee Kid.
We recycle, you know, and we recycle because of my wife. It's her. She gets all the credit for that. I would never recycle. If I was by my, I don't do it if she's not looking at me. So I would never do it if I was alone. I looked up a list of like, all right, like what are you supposed to do for global warming as an individual? And it was a big long list. But the first thing on the list was my favorite. It just said, just talk to your friends and family about it. Think about your friends and family. Like not the ones that are the good ones close. Think about the far out it goes. Just when you guys get together, like, do you mind if we talk about global warming? For I just thought this would be a good time to get into it. I had a great aunt and uncle fist fight each other at a wedding. Let me get in the middle of that fight. Any chance this fight was about global warming? Because I just would love to get that conversation rolling, you know?
Okay, so here he's this everyday kind of guy. I guess maybe he personifies what we're all thinking, like, oh, do we really have to talk about it with our friends and family? Grown.
Right. You know, that's the number one thing that climate scientists say to do is to just talk about it. Obviously, you know, do individual actions and, you know, vote and make your voice count in terms of policy. But in terms of other things you can do is just talk about it. And that just seems so far-fetched for thinking, okay, how is me talking about it actually helping the climate crisis? And it does, you know, helps bring awareness. It helps people keep reminding of it.
Yeah, but I think he's also making fun of the sort of weakness of that recommendation, like talking about it. Haven't we moved beyond that? Like, don't we need to do a little bit more than just talking about it with our friends and family?
Yeah, it's also like intelligently talking about it with your friends and family, right? And, you know, it's very complicated when you talk about these big issues because there are other research that show sometimes the facts aren't going to be the thing that appeals to other people because they're basing it more out of emotion. So just, you know, sticking someone with all the facts about something isn't necessarily going to help.
Does it matter which audience they're trying to appeal to? I'm imagining that Nate has a different audience than Michelle.
And that's also why I really liked his bit, right? Because, you know, you kind of get this with John Oliver, I think, too, right? And he acknowledges this. He says he's like preaching to the choir, right? Michelle Wolf also probably has an audience who is already on board for her, which is why she doesn't need to explain why climate change is real. Nate, on the other hand, I feel like he does appeal to probably a wider audience. And, you know, I think his bit can be construed in two ways. It can be like, you know, for people who they can identify with the struggle of trying to do this with their friends and family. Then you also have people on the other side who are like, yeah, you know, climate change is not worth talking about. But at the end of the day, he's talking about it and he's doing exactly what the climate scientists say, which is one of the number one things that you can do. So to me,
very meta.
Exactly. And I think that's just a very smart joke.
Okay. And here's one for the youngs, because the younger generation is probably more in tune with climate change than the older generation, because they're really going to have to face it. Here's Joel Kim Booster's Netflix special, Psychosexual. Here's a clip from that. And to set this one up, he's been talking to a couple in the audience about their relationship.
Do you think you guys want to have kids someday? You do? Oh, interesting. So you don't believe in climate change. Wild. Wow. What an interesting way to learn that. I'm just kidding. I'm kidding. Good luck to your kids. But no, listen, for real, I don't believe that overpopulation is the major issue at play here. I do think that if you want to have kids, you should have kids. But I do think that if you are having kids, knowing everything we know about the way the world is going, it is sort of like when you're at a party that you know is dying down. You know, and then you get a text from a friend and they're like, hey, should I still come to the party? And you're like, yeah, jump in that Uber, girl. I'm sure it'll be fine. I'm sure there will be ice still at the party by the time you get here. When what you should be doing is calling them immediately, being like, don't come here. Somebody has put on a podcast. Party is over.
I love how he just kind of, I don't know, subtly slides in the we're all going to die idea that we should not be having kids because everything is going to end very soon. So I guess you can laugh at that at the end of the world.
Well, what I really like about this bit is he does highlight one of the biggest questions on potential young parents' minds is, should we have kids given, you know, climate change, carbon footprint, etc. And I think that's also one thing when people think about climate change and what their individual actions are going to be, they think they have to sacrifice a lot of things. And one of the most important things they have to sacrifice is having a family at all, or having a large family, or whatever it might be. So yes, reducing kids can influence your carbon footprint, but some researchers would say that's not the largest possible thing that you can do. I don't know. Did I just talk in circles?
No, not at all. I get it. That it's not the worst thing you can do. It's not the best thing you can do. It's not the worst thing you can do.
Right. Yeah.
But I mean, it's also about just the guilt of having your children experience extreme weather that we don't even know what that's going to look like, really. And we're seeing it now in the beginnings of it, but it could be a lot worse. And I think a lot of potential parents are thinking, why would I subject my children to that?
Right. And that's kind of the bigger issue that he talks about. And, you know, hopefully if we do meet our goals of reducing our global temperatures, if we limit that, you know, we want to say 1.5 degrees Celsius, it might be 2 degrees Celsius or whatever it may be, you know, it will get a little bit worse in terms of extreme weather and things before it starts to get better.
Okay, I'm going to put you on the spot now because you're a comedian. What's your best climate change joke?
Oh my gosh. Climate change, I will say. So I specialize in science-themed comedy. I joke about everything, but I like writing about science. And climate change is one of the hardest things to write about, which is why I admire all the comedians who did it here. But one of a quick joke for the audience is my comedy career is a lot like climate change. It's pretty unbelievable, even though there's evidence of it occurring all around us. So
that's pretty good.
Thank you.
Tip your server. All right. Kasia Patel covers climate change and the environment at the Washington Post, where she writes their Hidden Planet column. And she's also a stand-up comedian. Kasia, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
The testy relationship between President Biden and Mexican President López Obrador.
Biden is sort of old school decorous, like believes, I think, in kind of traditional diplomacy and almost different. He's a nationalist. He's super focused on Mexico and he's stubborn and he thinks he knows what's best.
What can come out of the Three Amigos Summit next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Today, President Biden is in Mexico City for the so-called Three Amigos Summit, the U.S., Mexico, and Canada. But there's a little friction between the amigos. Yesterday, President Andrés Manuel López Obrador claimed the United States hasn't done anything substantive in the region since the Kennedy administration.
Therefore, I hold that this is the moment for us to determine to do away with this abandonment, this disdain, and this forgetfulness for Latin America and the Caribbean.
Biden bristled at that suggestion, pointing out the United States has spent tens of billions of dollars in Latin America over the past decade and a half.
Now, the United States provides more foreign aid than every other country just about combined in the world, to not just the hemisphere, but around the world. Unfortunately, our responsibility just doesn't end in the Western Hemisphere.
Biden's trip marks the first visit by a U.S. president to Mexico in nearly a decade, as the two countries struggle to tackle immigration and the smuggling of fentanyl into the U.S. Kate Linthicum is a foreign correspondent for the Los Angeles Times based in Mexico City. She's been covering all this. Welcome back to Press Play, Kate.
Hey.
All right. So this is the first time since 2014, hard to believe, that a U.S. president has been in Mexico. Donald Trump never went, and Mexico was, of course, a frequent target of his ire. However, he and López Obrador had a pretty good relationship. How come?
Well, I think AMLO, as the president here is known, you know, kind of understood Trump because they do share certain qualities. Both, you know, are very plain spoken, kind of antagonistic. You could call them trolls. And so I think he kind of understood, you know, how Trump operated, and also, you know, was afraid of some of the things that, Trump was threatening. At one point, he threatened to impose tariffs on imports from Mexico. So I think he was more cowed in that relationship. And with Biden, he's been much more antagonistic, and it's been a bit chilly, the relationship between the two.
And why is that? Didn't AMLO wait like about a month before congratulating Biden on his victory when he won the presidency?
Yeah, I mean, they have really different styles. You know, Biden is sort of old school, decorous, like very much believes, I think, in kind of traditional diplomacy, and very much believes in kind of U.S. The U.S. responsibility in the world beyond just sort of, you know, sort of from a diplomatic standpoint, and almost different. He's, you know, very much focused. He's a nationalist. He's super focused on Mexico. He doesn't care much for kind of traditional diplomacy. And he's stubborn, and he thinks he knows what's best. And so I think we saw those very different styles on display yesterday.
So what is at the top of the agenda? What does the United States want from Mexico, and what does Mexico want from the United States?
Yeah, well, officially, you know, they're discussing a number of different topics, ranging from trade to the drug war, to climate change and energy policy. But I think the real topic that has really come to dominate this bilateral relationship in recent years, and that is certainly dominating the talks this week, is migration. You know, the U.S. really depends on Mexico for help in enforcing its immigration policies. It has in recent years, you know, been turning back migrants to Mexico, and Mexican officials, you know, have been accepting migrants, and also like doing border enforcement at Mexico's southern border with Guatemala. So that's definitely on the agenda this week. And I think an interesting aspect of this is, as Mexico becomes kind of more important to the U.S. in terms of enforcing immigration policy, it kind of gets emboldened. Like, it's leveled the playing field a bit. You know, Mexico's economy depends so much on the U.S. that in the past, any kind of dialogue with the U.S. was a bit unbalanced, because the U.S. really, really dominates in at least economically. But now the U.S. desperately needs cooperation from Mexico. And so I think you see AMLO and other Mexican officials kind of, you know, recognizing that and being kind of more free with what they want and they need.
Interesting. And so where does Canada fit into all of this? Are they just kind of on the sidelines watching, or do they have a substantive role here?
No, they have a role. And I think, you know, the conversations particularly around trade and the free trade agreement that replaced NAFTA are very much at play here. You know, there's kind of a dispute between these three nations. AMLO has embraced this very retrograde energy policy that relies a lot on older, you know, fossil fuels like coal and oil. And he has kind of changed Mexico's energy policy to rely more on energy sources from within the country. Canada and the United States both say that those kind of nationalistic policies violate this trade agreement, and actually, you know, filed a formal complaint against that about that last year. So that is one of the tensions that's here, and that, you know, I think it's pretty clear that AMLO, who sees kind of Mexico's energy sovereignty, is not going to budge.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, the other big issue is, of course, illegal drugs, specifically fentanyl, which comes from Mexico and is the cause of thousands upon thousands of deaths here in the United States. So what does the Biden administration want Mexico to do more of? More cracking down on these drug cartels?
Yeah, I mean, basically that, you know, they want Mexico to do more to stop drugs being smuggled up to the border. It's more difficult with fentanyl and other synthetic drugs because, you know, unlike marijuana, which is, you know, a large kind of thing to smuggle, like, mm-hmm. these are these are, you know, very difficult to detect, you know, powders or pills. So there's a lot of challenges for the Mexicans, both in stopping the smuggling north and also the kind of illicit arrival of the precursor chemicals that come from Asia and that are used to make these drugs. I think what one of the things that the U.S. wants and that it's always wanted is for Mexico to go after the leaders of these cartels. And we saw last week that Mexico did that. And in what many here kind of believe was sort of a gift to the Biden administration ahead of the president's arrival here, they captured Ovidio Guzman, the son of El Chapo. Whether or not that has an actual impact on crime and drug smuggling is very much up for debate. You know, the arrest of these drug lords in the past hasn't traditionally, you know, had an effect on lowering violence or trafficking, but at least symbolically, it was important. And I think it was definitely a gift for Biden.
All right. Kate Linthicum, LA Times foreign correspondent based in Mexico City, where she's covering the Three Amigos Summit. Kate, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, a conversation with actor Brian Tyree Henry, star of the indie drama Causeway. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Brian Tyree Henry's career really blew up 7 years ago with the debut of the TV show Atlanta.
All right, you got me. I'm a rapper. You may have heard of me. Paperboy.
Oh, I know who you are. Mm-hmm. You're the guy who shot someone.
Well, it ain't really happened like that.
No, I'm actually Paperboy.
Who?
Paperboy. The rapper that your child was imitating.
You ain't Paperboy, man.
Yeah, I am, you little bitch.
His role as rapper Paperboy led to an Emmy nomination and a string of roles as an ensemble player, Godzilla vs. Kong, If Beale Street Could Talk, most recently the big-budget action film Bullet Train. But in the movie Causeway, he's one of the leads, and we see a different side of Brian Tyree Henry. In the quiet drama, he plays James, a mechanic who forms an unlikely friendship with a young veteran named Lindsay, who's played by Jennifer Lawrence.
Hey, you good? Hey, look, if it get dark now, you just ride it, okay?
Yeah.
Yeah.
How do I do that?
Joining me now is Brian Tyree Henry. Welcome back to Press Play.
It's so nice to be back. Thank you for having me.
It's so nice to have you back. Well, tell me, who is James? Tell us about this character.
James? Who is James? It's a great question. You know, we meet James in this place in his life where he is a person that has been dealt a hand that's been a little troubling for him. He was the driver in a terrible car accident, which cost him the loss of his nephew, which then also caused him the loss of his family that was still around. And it also caused him the loss of his leg. So he's now an amputee. And he is pretty much living a life of solitude ever since that accident happened, walking around with a lot of guilt, a lot of shame, and a lot of grief. And then one day he meets Lindsay, who comes to his auto body shop to just get her truck repaired. And in that meeting, I think he sees a glimmer of hope with actually creating a friendship with someone, with actually seeing somebody where he can kind of, you know, move from behind that curtain that he had been hiding behind. And to be seen for who he was before and to be seen anew. So, you know, James was a character that came to me that I kind of had a lot of hesitation with because I didn't want to judge him. You know, there was a lot in me that had a lot of judgments about, you know, where he was coming from and where he chose to stay. And I just was like, you know, rubbing up against that in such a huge way. I'm just like, well, why didn't he leave? And why is he in a place that reminds him of all the loss? And I think that I was screaming that mostly because Brian needed to unpack what that was for myself. And I think that he came at a time in my life where I was ready to really lay that down and unpack that.
That's really interesting that you said you had a lot of judgment about this character for not getting on with his life, being stuck, I guess,
right.
in one place,
which right.
ends up being the theme of the movie, like whether you should move on or stay. I guess I'm wondering why you were so judgy of him for doing that, for trying to staying in his hometown and just being.
That's a fair question. Absolutely fair question. I think, you know, because I was battling my own things when it came to James, because I was a person, uh-huh. you know, I pretty much fashioned myself as being a person like a runaway, right? Like if it didn't suit me and it didn't feel right, then I got the hell out of there. You know, I was the kind of person that was like, okay, well, if nothing changes, right? So why don't you go somewhere, figure it out, go see what's going on. And I always had questions for people that chose to stay. And to be completely transparent, I also had judgments about them. Those people who chose to stay where they are, who chose to deal with the cards that were given to them. And I'm like, no, man, like there's gotta be something more. So basically what I discovered in playing James is that it actually takes more courage and more strength to stay. It actually takes more to actually stay where you are, because then that means that there's something that you yourself have accepted, something that you yourself have decided for yourself that is actually like beneficial to your growth and development. I always mm-hmm. came from a place where I just, you know, I'd always run away, you know, from things. Mm-hmm. I'd always been the one to like venture out and go somewhere else.
But is that running away or running to?
You know, look at you. that's a good question. But for me, I was usually told that it was running away. It was always from the people who were observing what I was doing that I was told that it was kind of a running away and not standing in my power and confronting it. But now that you've said that, I guess it was more of a running to, because in the running to something, you know, I'm sitting here with you, you know, discussing this film. In the running to, yeah. I'm getting this kind of recognition for what I've been doing.
Yeah. Because you're from Fayetteville, North Carolina, right? It's a military town.
Yes, I am. Yes, I am. Yeah.
So had you stayed, what do you think you'd be doing now?
I don't necessarily know. There was just no such thing as staying for me, honestly. And I don't think that the powers that be, including my family and my friends, would have allowed me to do that in the first place. A big reason why I am where I am today is because of the people who saw something in me and really told me to go for it. You know, like, I can't lie that there is a part of naivete that I've gotten by in life with, because, you know, I'm still a student. You know, I'm always willing to learn things. I'm always, you know, in this precocious stage of life where I really want to discover things and figure things out. But like, I also am a person who knows how to listen and take notes. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I'm also a person that if someone is like, no, maybe you should try this, actually, it would behoove you if you actually leaned into this a little bit more. What could it hurt in trying, you know? Because I know what the other side looks like to not have anybody say anything, to actually feel like you're overlooked, to feel like nobody's there to champion you. So when you get that voice from somebody that's like, hey, what if you gave it a shot? Like, what can it hurt to give yourself a fighting chance? That was also another level that totally broke through for me with playing James. Is like, yo, what is the harm in giving yourself a shot? What is the harm in actually trying something new? What is the harm in actually being seen by somebody? Like, to really be seen by somebody, no matter how hard you've tried to hide it and tuck it down, somebody can see through the cracks and actually see the potential of what you can be. And that was what I wanted to explore mostly in Causeway.
Yeah, so there is a literal revelation in one scene where they're in a swimming pool and it's late at night, and it's just the two of them.
Yeah.
And she's trying to get him into the pool, and your character doesn't want to go into the pool. And then finally she convinces him, and there's this really powerful scene where he takes off his pants and takes off his prosthetic leg.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that scene and what you're getting at there?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing with that scene, I often refer to that scene as the baptism scene. Because, you know, baptisms are a place where we essentially get all our sins washed away if we just, you know, give ourselves over, you know, to Christ or whatever that is that you know, you believe. And then you apparently come out anew. And so when approaching this scene, there were a few things that I had to always keep in mind. And that was the sense of danger. One, because technically we are breaking and entering on a property that is not ours in the middle of the night, drinking and imbibing and having a good time. So our guards are down. So I wanted to make sure that was something that you got to feel James actually get to release. He gets to let his guard down. Mm-hmm. And not only that, there's an exposure that happens. And I thought of a few things with that, because here you meet these two people who are now labeled as disabled. And usually what I think of is like, what are the resources that are no longer given to you because now you're considered disabled? And so something as simple as swimming was something that I thought about with James, like what it actually means to disrobe and expose yourself to someone, to actually show them the process that you have to do daily just to get in a pool, like to take your leg off and to really like trust that this person, A, will not judge you, will not have any kind of reaction, will actually allow you to just be. And so that scene in particular, I remember us doing it that night, a few nights, and with the great direction of Lila, it was able to be as intimate as it was. And so, you know, there were a few things, you know, like I think like the unpacking of exposure for both of them, honestly, because then you get to see Lindsay get back to this carefreeness of who she is. You get to see her actually have this connection with somebody where she wants to be a little bit more carefree, where she wants to actually just forget about all the realities that are outside those, the compound, that compound that they're in. It's just like, you know, let's meet and explore what it is to be free, to submerge ourselves for a second. And you get to see that with James. I mean, and that was another thing that I really loved about the exploration of these two characters, is this kind of teenage, kind of adolescent wonder about each other, you know, where there was this moment or these moments that these two characters got to let everything down and actually meet somebody where they are, you know, either it be going to get snowballs or just giving somebody a ride or going through CDs and playing, you know, that was the greatness about it, is that the lightness came out of them the more and more they were around each other. Mm-hmm. And they were no longer just their disabilities anymore. They weren't, you know, bogged down by what everyone had told them that they couldn't do, what their potential couldn't be.
So he gets in. And he feels absolved for a moment.
Kind of.
And then something happens, and he's right back where he was. And I guess I want to ask you about the romance or the lack of romance in this movie.
Go for it.
Why aren't they more romantic? And I know she states that she likes women and not men, but why do you think that was a plot point?
We had several talks about this, Jennifer, Lila, and I, when it came to the
Lila's
connection.
The director.
Yes, Lila Neugebauer, our director. And I think that what we all really wanted was we wanted this to be an exploration of a friendship that just existed, you know, that didn't have to come with the weight of will they, won't they? What if it was just two people who honestly were meeting each other in this space and time and needed nothing more from each other than to find a place of healing? Who needed nothing more than to actually have someone see them for who they are and where they are, and to have somebody kind of usher them back to the place where they started. And that's, you know, that kind of carefreeness, you know, there were a lot of tropes that we didn't want to bring to the surface. You know, we were very, very conscious and aware of this Black man and this white woman in space and what the intimacy could look like. We wanted it to just exist. We wanted it to just be this thing where you actually watched these two people exist and actually no longer be what their burdens were. Sometimes we hold on to our wounds and to our losses like they're tender babies. You know, we carry them with us. Some of us don't even know who we are without them. And I think for James and Lindsay, you get to watch them both finally take whatever this heavy load of what they've been carrying with them or that has been put upon them and get to lay it down.
But it does seem like he wants to have something romantic happen.
I don't necessarily think so. I think that what happens is you have a man that is vulnerable, has his guard down. You have this person. Uh-huh. He's literally finally cried and opened up himself. And there's a person that came in and showed affection. I don't even know the last time that James had anybody hug him. For most of it, James has been made to blame. I mean, how could he ever feel like he could have anybody show him any affection when he is responsible for the loss of this young child? Like, and I'm sure that he felt that he never even deserved it. So the minute that this woman decides to throw her arms around me and show me some kind of affection, I think that you finally get to see him let that guard down of actually being, of actually feeling like he deserves to be cared for.
But then he's denied a deeper connection in terms of a romantic.
Yeah, it's shot down, isn't it?
Yeah. And that seems like, oh, so then he's not deserving of it.
But then you also get to see the redemption of him defending himself by actually, like, he fixes the truck. And he goes on about his life. He kind of just says, you know, well, that's what that was. Let me go back to my life of how it was. He tells her exactly how he feels about her, you know, because there's no easy exit for him in that scene. That was something that was really frustrating for me, too, because I was like, well, here you have this person that got me to jump in this pool, to disrobe, to take off this leg. And then this moment happens. And there's not even a quick way for me to escape. Like, in order for me to really get out of here, I then have to swim, pull myself onto this ledge, get back onto this chair, put this sleeve back on, put this leg back on. But at the end of the day, he got to leave everything there. There are things that he got to say that he had never said before. I don't think that he ever got a chance to truly be seen in that way by anybody. And he got to leave it there. He got to leave himself bare. So, you know, yes, like, that was the thing. You're still dealing with two people who were damaged in their own way. And yet, at the end of the day, she found her way back to him and really came to him with an offering of a friendship, of really starting over again. I think that that was the truest exploration that we wanted to show, is just like what it means to begin again, because usually beginning is truly the hardest part. How many of us always tell ourselves, yeah, I'll start it tomorrow. We all do this.
Scary.
We all are so good. It's terrifying, but it's also so gratifying when you get to begin with someone that's going to actually hold you accountable. That's actually going to be like, you know what, it's scary for me too. And I think that you meet these two characters in these places where they haven't been told a lot of what they can start again. They've made up in their minds of like, no, this is kind of what I deserve. In each other, they get to discover the possibility of how to begin.
Yeah, no, it is a beautiful idea the way it ends. Even though the movie, I have to say, it's not a joyful movie to watch, but it is a really sensitive and moving piece of work. How you felt doing that versus the other big movie you did, Bullet Train, where you play an assassin. I mean, it's a really fun movie, but
both
it's a totally
men
fun.
Have their own journeys, right? You know, what I really loved the most about playing Lemon was his connection to his brother, Tangerine, right? Like, here you have this duo who, by whatever the circumstances of life were, they have become these assassins and a team of assassins. And what I really loved the most about it was exploring the brotherhood between Aaron and I and what that really looked like. Like, your mission is to kill people professionally and murder people, but yet you're going on this mission with somebody you truly love and care about. And that is what was the most fulfilling for me, because it was about the nurture, honestly. Like, I always think about my characters and like what their nurture was to get them to where they were, who got them there, what did they lack in the department of nurturing that got them to be who they are, but also how much they need to be nurtured. And so I think that that juxtaposition between James and Lemon is kind of the same, because you also see James being someone who is by nature a good nurturer. He is a man of service. He actually is a guy that actually cares about other people, but then doesn't believe that he deserves to be cared about. Because at the end of the day, all the characters that I play, I want people to nurture them. I want people to care about them. I want people to leave their living rooms or leave the movie theater and just think for a second, are these men okay? I know it's easy for people to pass judgment on characters and see things like, you know, and just be like, oh, well, I don't like this person. Oh, this person clearly did that. But if I can just provide a little bit of light onto how you can nurture them and care for them, then I've done my job. With James, I really wanted people to lean in a little bit more and figure out if he was going to get to the other side. I didn't want him to be a toss away, nor do I want any of my characters to ever be that. I want them to leave an impression. I want you to think about them just for a second. I want you to want more of them, actually, because in that it helps them want more for themselves. You know, whether it be Lemon, whether it be Alfred, whether it be James, I still want there to be a sense of care for people whenever you welcome them into your home or welcome them into your vision line of view, that there's a nurture that you kind of want to give them.
Yeah. Well, it helps that you have a very soulful face and big searching eyes.
Thank you. That is a compliment I will never forget for the rest of my life. Thank you. Thank you.
You are welcome. Well, I'm going to miss you as Paperboy, as Alfred, but I'm really excited to see what you do next.
So am I. And thank you for supporting it. And thank you. Just thank you.
No, oh, you are so welcome. And I hope it won't be another 6 years before we talk
again. I know. Yeah. Let's not go this long again. Okay.
Okay. Brian Tyree Henry, he is starring in Causeway, which is currently streaming on Apple TV+. And that's it for the show today. Thanks so much for listening today. You know, you can listen again or listen to past episodes or future episodes by checking out our podcast. It's at kcrw.com/pressplay or wherever else you get your podcasts. It's entirely free and it updates every single day. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.